Greetings and welcome back to our continuing podcasts of Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther. We are now on the penultimate chapter, chapter 9, which is the largest chapter in Megillat Esther, and is one of the few chapters in all of Nevi'im and Ketuvim to include sections of halachic practice. The chapter is fairly neatly divided into two sections, one that describes the events of that particular year during three very powerful days, 13th, 14th, and 15th of Adar, taking you through verse 18, and concluding with the last verses, which describe the evolution and development of the holiday and a brief explanation of the holiday itself. There's another example of the doubled dating in which the text seems to be addressing an audience that does not know what the 12th month is anymore, and therefore has to explain that it's Adar, on the 13th of the month. This is the day that the king's word and his ruling were supposed to be fulfilled, which was both documents, both decrees pointed to that day. By Yom Asher Sibru, Ayveyodim Lishlot Bahem, the day that the enemies of the Jews anticipated, Sibru, they looked forward, Lishlot Bahem, to rule over the Jews, Fanafochu, it was turned upside down, and that of course is the theme of the entire Megillah, Asher Yisletu Ayudim Hema Vesonehem, that the Jews themselves ruled over their enemies. In other words, things got turned upside down on that very day. Now, there's something a little bit misleading about this pasuk, because normally when we talk about anticipating something and being surprised or having it turn around, that's when the anticipation lasts from the first moment of awareness until just the moment of the event. And at the moment of the event, it turns out differently. A basketball player throws up a shot from 60 feet away with the game tied, and everybody assumes that the game is going to go into overtime, and surprise, surprise, it goes through the basket and the team wins. That's an anticipation that at the very last moment is relieved or resolved with surprise. Here it's a little bit different because the original documents had gone out in Nisan. A scant 2 months and 10 days later, the next set of documents went out, and remember, the entire event was going to take place nearly a year later. So for most of that time, the enemies already knew that the decree concerning the Jews was in their favor, the new decree. Nonetheless, it's possible that the enemies of the Jews still thought, we have the official rights of the first decree to go out and we may defeat the Jews. In the reality, it played out the opposite. In other words, what happened? The Jews gathered in their cities throughout the provinces to attack those who wanted to hurt them, which means now the Jews gathered and didn't just act in self-defense, but they went after the people who evidently had planned to be part of this, if you will, pogrom on the day. And nobody even stood up to them because everybody was afraid of them, which means this really was a one-sided massacre. All of the princes and members of the king's government were raising up the Yehudim, kenafal pachad Mordechai aleihem, because they were afraid of Mordechai. Why? Ki gadol Mordechai beveit hamelach. Mordechai was very powerful in the palace. V'shamo holech b'chol medinot, that his reputation spread throughout the provinces, and you can well imagine, as happens, that my reputation spread by word of mouth away from the neck, from the point of origin, the legends grow, and Mordechai suddenly 7 feet tall, and Mordechai suddenly, can burn people with his eyes, etc. Very likely those are the sort of things that were happening. Ka'ish Mordechai olech gadol, because Mordechai indeed was continuing to grow. And now we see the details of the battle. Vayeku yadim b'chol oyvehem, makat cherev v'hereg v'avdan. So the Jews attacked their enemies with a sword, heragma means strangling, and they destroyed them. They did whatever they wanted to their enemies, total control. And the counting is, in Shushan alone, the Jews killed 500 people, and plus, v'yei parshandata, v'yei tafon, v'yei taspata, v'yei tmorata, v'yei tadalia, v'yei taridata, v'yei pramashta, v'yei tarisai, v'yei taridai, v'yei tvazata. right, who are Aseret Bnei Haman Ben Hamdata Tzora Yudim Haragu, which is a little bit curious, because as we already pointed out in the previous chapter, Mordechai was their lord, and they were slaves to him, and likely they were not going to join some sort of militia at this point to try to kill Jews, but nonetheless they were the sons of Haman, they themselves were enemies, and therefore they were killed. And to the Jews' credit, they did not take any of the spoils, even though the decree said that they had rights to the spoils. There are those who point out that the association between this war and the war of Shaul against Agag, and that in this war there was a reparation, a tikkun, if you will, of the error of the people in Shaul's time who kept the flock. Here the Jews did not touch anything of the bizav. And the number of the dead in Shushan comes to the king, and that's the report. Now, Esther appears before the king. Parenthetically, the list of the sons of Haman, there are two points about it. One is that that listing is graphically represented in a Megillah as a shira, as a piece of poetry, in which the name of the son of Haman is on one side, and then the word ve'et is on the other side. These are two columns with a space in the middle, and the Chachamim explain the reason it's written that way is so they should be piled on top of each other and should have no way to climb out and come back and haunt us. There is a halacha, which is that all 10 names ideally are read in one breath, and the idea is they all died together. But remember, they died by the sword or by strangulation, not by being impaled, although that will happen to them the next day once they're already dead. So the king turns to Esther, who has come before the king. We'll find out a little bit more in a minute. And says, in Shushan, they killed 500 men, and the 10 sons of Haman. What happened in the rest of the kingdom? And then he said to her, what is your request, and what do you want? Again, the same language, which means what's happened is, Esther has come before the king for a fifth time. The first time she came to the king was after the third day of the fast. The next time was at the banquet. The next time was at the second banquet. The next time was when she came to the king's throne room again for the second time and begged to have the order repealed, and everything played out the way it did. And now, here is a fifth time where she comes to the king. But here, you see, she's just coming in. She's not falling at his feet, and she's not acting timid. She walks in. The king recognizes her and asks her what else she wants. And by the way, notice, the protocol has been cut short. If the king approves, and she doesn't go, if I'm good in his eyes, and he wants to do it, etc., let the Jews in Shushan tomorrow be able to do what they did today. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged up, meaning they're already dead. Hang their carcasses up tomorrow so everybody will see this is what happens, and the usual reason for public execution. And the king ordered it, and that's exactly what happened, and the Jews were told they had one more day to fight in Shushan. And that's a wrap-up of the war. The Jews fought, got gathered in Shushan also on the 14th of Adar, and they fought, and they killed 300 more men, which brings the total to 810, and they did not touch any of the spoils. So the Jews throughout the provinces gathered, and they stood up for themselves, and they got respite from their enemies, and they killed there, those who hate them, 75,000 worth. Uvabizalo shachod yadam. And again, they did not take any of the spoils. And when was this? Beyom shlosha asar lechodesh Adar. It was on the 13th. V'noach bi'arba asar bo. And they rested on the 14th. V'aso oto yom mishtem simcha. And naturally, the day after they defeated their enemies, on the 14th, they made a party. Now it's summing it up, saying, and the Jews in Shushan gathered on the 13th and the 14th, and they rested on the 15th, and they made the 15th into a day of Simcha. Up until there is the history of that year. Now the text jumps forward, either a year or, as the Ramban suggests, several years. What does Osim mean? It means they celebrate, they do. In other words, it's now a description of an ongoing thing. At Yomar Ba'asar L'Chodesh Adar, so the Yehudim HaPrazim, the Jews who live in the unwalled cities, and there's a play on words here because Prazim in ancient Farsi means victorious. So it would read, the victorious Jews living in the unwalled cities, Osim et Yomar Ba'asar L'Chodesh Adar, they make the 14th of Adar, Simcha u'mishtevi yom tov, a day of happiness and rejoicing and a banquet or drinking and a holiday. U'mishtoach manot ishtereihu. And also they instituted or they added a new feature, which was that they would send food to each other, whether it meant to share the meal or to make sure that the poor also had what to celebrate with, unclear. The mention of manot here seems to be associated with the mention in Nehemiah Perak Chet, where Ezra tells the people that on Rosh Hashanah it's a festive day and they shouldn't be sad, and Shilchu Manot La'ein Nachon Lo, send portions of food to someone who doesn't have so they can also celebrate. That may mean what it means here. So Mordechai now writes this down, which means that the first step that happened was all of the events happened, and then a year or several years later, Jews in unwalled cities decided as a grassroots effort, this is following the Ramban's description in the beginning of its Chiddush of Masechet Megillah, the Jews decided as a grassroots effort in the unwalled cities only to make the 14th a yearly celebration with feasting and also with sharing food. Then Mordechai wrote these words down, and it's possible that he wrote these with the seal of the king, or he wrote them with the seal of his own Jewish leadership. As a member of the Sanhedrin, as Chazal suggest, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces, whether they're near or far, that they should accept upon themselves to celebrate the 14th and the 15th. Now notice, the 15th has not yet been celebrated. It was, that first year was the day after the victory, but as a holiday it wasn't yet set up. The 14th was set up by grassroots initiative. So he said they should celebrate the 14th and the 15th every year, just like the days that the Jews got respite from their enemies that year. And the month that it turned, because of course, remember, the whole lottery was about the month. So the month that it turned from sadness to happiness and from mourning to holiday, Lasot otam yemei mishteves simcha, that the Jews should make them days of rejoicing, and mishloach manot ish l're'ehu u'matanot evyonim. This now puts mishloach manot ish l're'ehu in a different category, because matanot evyonim means gifts to the poor, so mishloach manot ish l're'ehu means among friends sharing food. Manot is portions of food. V'kibel ha'udim et asher chelu lasot et asher katam Mordechai aleihem, and the Jews indeed accepted it. Why? And now we get a mini retell of the story for three psukim. Bingo, very quickly. Haman, who the enemy of the Jews, decided to try to kill the Jews. We have to mention the lots for a reason. He threw down a pur, which is a goral, again, we have to know what that means, to confuse them and to destroy them. And when she came before the king, Amar im ha-sefer, and this seems to be an allusion to the divine, Yashuv machshavto ra'ah shechashav l'yudim al rosho talutot banav ala eitz, that his plans should come back to haunt him. In other words, what he planned for them should happen to him. And they ended up impaling him and his sons on a tree. Now, of course, that's not what he planned for the Jews. Plus, he was hanged in one context at one time and his sons in a very different context in a very different time. But for purposes of this historiosophic summary, we conflate the events together to show the poetic justice, as we say in Al Hanisim, Veshevoto lo gmolo gmolo v'rosho, t'lo otov et panav ala eitz. He and his sons being metaphorically together, or figuratively together, on the tree, impaled, is the poetic justice here. Now, the question is, Al ken karu le'emim ha'ele furim al shem ha'pur. Why are they, so the people call this Purim, it's a people's holiday, and they call it Purim, and they called it Purim because of the poor. Al-Kain, al-Kol Divrei HaYerat HaZot. And it's all because of this particular letter, and the letter is referring to itself. And the question is, Umar Rol Kachamai Gialehem, why did the Jews get this? The answer is Kimuvi Kibloa Yudim Alem Vial Zaram Vial Kol Avim Alehem Velo Yavor. The Jews accepted upon themselves and upon their children, upon anyone who would join them, like a convert, and it would never be repealed. Liot Osim Et Shtei Yamim Ha'Ele Kichtavam Chizmanam B'Chol Shana V'Shana, that they should fulfill these days just as it's written in the proper time every year. And Vayamim Ha'Ele Nizkarim V'Nasim. Question is this part of their commitment, or is this already a description? These days either will be remembered and fulfilled, or are remembered and fulfilled, B'Chol Dor V'Dor. Huge difference, because if we read it the second way, these days have been remembered and fulfilled for generations, that means that the text is finally being edited generations later, testifying that Purim is now a concretized, regular part of the calendar. B'chol dor v'dor mishpacha u'mishpacha, famous Rashav Chazal, that's there to include the Kohanim, medina u'medina v'ir v'ir, to distinguish between Shushan and other walled cities, between walled cities and underwalled cities, famous Rashav Chazal, but the simple pshat is, in every province and in every city, the question is whether this is an observation, a part of the ruling, or a prophecy is dealt with differently. In some Mekorot, it's dealt with as a prophecy, and therefore the famous Midrash Mishlei says that even if all the other holidays eventually are canceled, Purim will never leave because the Lo Yavru Mitoch HaYudim, and indeed the Rambam uncharacteristically quotes that at the very end of Hilchot Megillah, when he points out that Megillat Esther and Chumash will be the only Kitvei Kodesh to remain at some particular point in future history, and all of the holidays will be canceled except for Purim, based on that drasha, based on that pasuk. Okay, so far the stages that we've had are the events of the year, then in later years the unwalled cities celebrating, and then Mordechai sending out a letter, and for right now we'll follow the Ramban's lead under the guise of Jewish leadership, under the directorate of Jewish leadership, invoking that everyone should celebrate the 14th and the 15th, and then Vatichtov Esther Malkava Tevichah Mordechai Yudi at Kol Tokef. Now Esther and Mordechai wrote a letter at Kol Tokef, which indicates with the power of the seal of the king. That there was a second letter written out, which means the first letter included the story, and the second letter now includes the story and about the first letter, and now what we're reading, which was, so it was sent out, shalom to the Yehudim, etc., and it was sent out throughout the province of Ahasuerus. That indicates that this was a royal letter. And what did the letter say? That the Jews should fulfill these holidays in their time. Now, why is there a need for a second letter? So Ramban suggests, and makes it's very reasonable, that the Jews in Shushan had a problem celebrating even after Mordechai, as Rabbi Mordechai, if you will, as a Jewish leader had directed them to, because it's very, very dangerous to celebrate a victory over Persians in a Persian city like Shushan, in a Jewish city where there's only Jews there to celebrate. But to celebrate where your neighbor might be having a yard sale the same day because you killed his uncle or his father, it's going to be very difficult. So that's why it's written with the seal of the king, and then people celebrate and say, we're just following the king's orders. And like Mordechai and Esther fulfilled upon themselves and accepted upon themselves and on their children all of the fasting, and that, of course, we did not accept. And now Esther's word is what really made Purim happen, and it was written in a scroll. And with that, we finish Perek Tet, Perek Chi'i, which, as I said, is the longest Perek in Megillat Esther, and carries with it the evolution, development of the Chag, and mentions the famous obligations of the day of Mishteh, and of Simcha, and of Matanot Levyonim, and Mishloach Manot, etc. It only alludes to the mitzvah Mikra Megillah through the words, Hayamim Ha'elen Niz Karim V'Na'asim, these days are remembered and observed, of which Chazal make build on that, the notion of Mikra Megillah as being built into the day. But as we see, this is a holiday that has gone through several stages, and by the time the final copy of the Megillah is prepared, it has gone through stages until it is now a formal holiday, which not only has the imprimatur of the Jewish leadership, but it also has the informator of the Persian king, and therefore throughout the empire, Jews are not only allowed to, they are indeed ordered to celebrate this holiday, in spite of the fact that they may be offending some of their neighbors. There's a beautiful and highly recommended passage that I alluded to, I quoted several times during this podcast, which is the Ramban's commentary on the opening passage in Masechet Megillah. I believe it's available in some place on the internet in English, where he describes the development of the holiday and why it is that the other walled cities were also given the 15th of Shushan, the 15th of Adar, like Shushan, known as Shushan Purim. In any case, that's beyond the scope of the Shiur here. And in the last podcast, which will be very brief, we will complete the 10th and final chapter of Megillat Esther. In the meantime, everybody should have a wonderful day.